content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hi, this is Mike Urban from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from Smithsonian, the magazine of the Smithsonian Institution in Washington, D.C. Today's programming is underwritten with the generous support from Carl and Pat Keppen. We thank them for their support. This reading comes from Smithsonian.com. The fascinating story of the Texas Archives War of 1842. Far from consequential, the battle over where the papers of the Republic of Texas should reside reminds us of the politics of historical memory. By Sheila McClear. The French philosopher Jacques Derrida once declared, "There is no political power without control of the archive, if not of memory." Though he wasn't writing about the Texas Archives War of the mid-1800s, and why would he, considering its obscurity, he very well could have been. In the summer of 1839, when the nascent Republic of Texas faced a threat from the Mexican army to the south, a bitter dispute over the young nation's archives brought to light how closely power and history are connected. The conflict in which state politicians used the archives as a means of bestowing legitimacy upon their preferred capital cities is a fascinating moment in history. According to many Texas historians, it played a major part in why Austin is today the capital of Texas. The Republic of Texas grew out of the Texas Revolution, an 1835 uprising of U.S. colonists and Tejanos that put up armed resistance against the Mexican government. The issue at hand was autonomy. The rebels refused to accept governmental changes that left total power with the national government and the Mexican president, instead of with the state and local government. Formed on March 2, 1836, the Republic of Texas governed as an independent nation until becoming a part of the United States in 1845. That brief 9-year period of self-governance was anything but peaceful. The Mexican government refused to recognize Texas as an independent state, and its army frequently raided the southern and western boundaries well into the 1840s. Modeled on the U.S. Congress with a bicameral legislature elected by the population at large, the Congress of Texas represented about 70,000 people, according to the first and only census taken in 1840. 5 Texas cities served as temporary capitals in the Republic's first year of existence, jumping around to evade Mexican capture before Sam Houston, elected the Republic's second president, chose the city of Houston, already named after him, as the capital in 1837. The Republic's archives, including military records, official papers, land titles, war banners and trophies, the seal of the government and international treaties, came from the city of Columbia to Houston with the new designation, according to historian Dorman Winfrey, who wrote about the Texas Archives War more than 50 years ago. The next president, Mirabeau Lamar, an attorney from Georgia, who believed that the literal extinction of Native Americans was necessary for progress, moved the capital to Austin in 1839 because of the city's central location. Detractors, the most vocal of whom was Sam Houston, felt that Austin was too remote, too underdeveloped, and too close to Mexican and Native American enemies, mostly from the Comanche and Cherokee nations. Houston, the city, meanwhile, enjoyed greater access to trade with its close proximity to the Gulf of Mexico. Sam Houston ascended to the presidency a second time in 1841, inheriting Austin as the capital, and he made no bones about how much he hated the city, often calling it the most unfortunate site on earth for a seat of government, and refusing to move into the official residence, preferring instead to take a room at a boarding house. Having won 3/4 of the vote, Houston felt empowered to move the capital back to his namesake city. He agitated for such a change with the legislature, but representatives defeated his proposals. Austinites had hometown pride, but their obstinacy went beyond that. losing the capital would stunt the growth of their rapidly developing city and result in a drop in property values. Sam Houston was, in their minds, abandoning the seat of government and exaggerating the seriousness of the Mexican threat to achieve his political aims. In early March of 1842, 700 Mexican troops under General Rafael Vazquez crossed the Republic of Texas borders, and by March 5th occupied San Antonio, about 80 miles from Austin. Officials declared martial law. Many families left for somewhere safer. In the aftermath of the attack, Houston feared the worst in what was to come. Letters to his fiancée expressed true concern of not only Mexican attack, but that Comanches would burn and destroy the city, and crucially its archives as well. Houston felt strongly that Austin was not a safe place for the Republic's capital. As he wrote on March 24, 1842, "The destruction of the National Archives would entail irremediable injury upon the whole people of Texas. Should the infinite evil which the loss of the National Archives would occasion fall upon the country through the president's neglect of imperious constitutional duty, he would be culpable in the extreme and must justly incur the reproach of a whole nation." A couple of weeks earlier, President Houston had ordered his Secretary of War, George W. Hockley, to move the archives out of Austin to Houston, and Thomas Pegleg Ward, the new commissioner of the General Land Office, which dealt with public lands and patents and maintained government records, was told to prepare the archives for transport. The military commander in Austin, Colonel Henry Jones, had other plans. He opposed the order and convened furious citizens to discuss the proposition. Together, they formed a committee of vigilance to stop the transport and guard the archives. To them, the attack on San Antonio was overblown and being used as a pretext to move the capital from their city. Houston called a special session of Congress to resolve the matter, which met on June 27th. He stressed the importance of moving the capital and the archives, but an indifferent legislature made no move to change the rule on the matter. That fall, Mexican troops again attacked San Antonio, urging Houston to reassemble the Congress, which this time met in Washington on Brazos, a new capital city that was neither Austin nor Houston, on December 5, 1842. Houston once again asked for support of an executive resolution removing the archives to the new capital, no matter what the so-called seditious citizens of Austin had to say about it, according to Patsy McDonald, author of the Texas Senate, Republic to Civil War, 1836 to 1861. Senate President Edward Burleson, who disliked Sam Houston, declined to support the procedural matter that would result in the transfer of the archives, and the motion stalled in a tie. With no success through official channels, Houston took matters into his own hands, outside Congress, outside the government. On December 10th, he secretly ordered two Texas Army officers, Captain Eli Chandler and Colonel Thomas I. Smith, to gather a force of 20 men, retrieve the archives from Austin with secrecy, efficiency, and dispatch, and take them to Washington on Brazos. Wrote Houston on that day, "The importance of removing the public archives and government stores from their present dangerous situation at the city of Austin to a place of security is becoming daily more and more imperative. While they remain where they are, no one knows the hour when they may be utterly destroyed." On December 30th, the covert force entered Austin in the early morning and were loading the archives, with an assist from Ward, into wagons, when Angelina Eberle, a local innkeeper, came across them. The owner of several city lots, in addition to her inn, Eberle understood the symbolic value the archives had to the Republic. Having already lost the capital to Washington on Brazos, losing the archives would ensure Austin would be left out of the future of Texas. She quickly spread the word amongst Austinites, and a small ad hoc army gathered. According to Winfrey's history, on Austin's main thoroughfare, Congress Avenue, sat a loaded 6-pound howitzer loaded with grape shot, a remnant from the Republic's earlier wars with Native Americans. She turned the muzzle toward the land office and applied the torch, and the cannon was discharged, according to D.G. Wooten, author of A Complete History of Texas. There was a cry of "blow the old house to pieces," recounted Ward in a letter addressed to Sam Houston. Some shots hit the land office, but no one was injured and no damage was done, wrote Winfrey. Ward, who had lost his right arm to a malfunctioning cannon earlier in his military career, was lucky to get out of harm's way. Smith, Chandler, and their men took off with the archives in their wagons, pursued by about 20 vigilante Austinites, some carrying the cannon. Around noon the next day at Bushy Creek, just north of Austin, the Austin mob held the troops at gunpoint, giving Smith the alternative to surrender or fight, wrote Winfrey. Although there are several versions of the story, in the account written by Wooten, the mob forced Smith to move the archives back to Austin, while Ward states that the vigilantes hauled the archives back themselves. Regardless, Smith was compelled to surrender the archives, which were dutifully returned to Austin. The Committee of Vigilance members celebrated their victory with a New Year's party in the form of a hearty meal. Some accounts say they even invited Colonel Smith to join in, and he accepted gladly. Others say he declined. Either way, the bloodless conflict was, for the time being, over. With the land office damaged, the archives needed a new home, and according to historian Lewis Wills Camp, all records were then sealed in tin boxes and stored at Mrs. Eberly's under day and night guard. An attempt to take them by force would have precipitated a civil war. This turn of affairs left Ward unhappy, as he wrote to Houston. I have employed all the exertion I could to have them restored to this place, but in vain. And what the result may be, Providence alone can determine. Many threats have been made against me, but however dangerous or unpleasant my situation may be, I will not complain if I can do a service to the Republic. Soon after, the Congress investigated Houston's actions and later reprimanded him. A Senate committee concluded that Houston had no legal reasons to attempt moving the archives. While the archives stayed in Austin, the seat of government continued to stay in Washington on Brazos, and Austin, without the status associated with capital cities, turned into a ghost town. Throughout the first half of 1843, after repeated failures by Ward to reclaim the archives for his agency, he created a new land office in Washington on Brazos, where new archives were already being created as the government went about its business. On July 4, 1845, at last and without much strife or anguish, the two archives were reunited in Austin. The Republic of Texas joined the United States of America a few months later, on December 29th of that year. Austin, perhaps more than any other city in the U.S., has stridently asserted itself and its identity as a capital city from its beginning, and the Archives Wars was a fascinating blip on its journey to becoming the modern, self-assured city it is today. The issue of the Texas state's capital wasn't firmly resolved until 1850, when Texans voted by a large majority to choose scrappy, mighty Austin as their capital and seat of government. Its position as capital city was cemented with yet another, this time final, statewide vote in 1872, marking the end to a very strange, very long journey. Now, another article from Smithsonian.com. What makes the Nobel-winning breakthroughs in immunotherapy so revolutionary? Targeting the immune system to fight cancer could be the first step to defeating the disease, by Dwayne Mitchell, professor of neurosurgery, University of Florida. This was originally published in The Conversation. There are moments in the history of scientific achievement that benchmark the end of an era and the beginning of a new phase of reality for mankind. The significance of these inflection points is sometimes readily apparent. NASA astronaut Neil Armstrong's first step onto the surface of the moon on July 20, 1969, marked a new phase of space exploration. Other advances take many years for the historical significance to manifest, with an impact that appreciates over decades. That was the case with the development of the mechanized clock of the 15th century and the invention of the telephone in 1876. Attempts to rid people of their cancer burden date back to 1600 BC, when the disease was first recognized. But the idea of using a patient's own immune system to eliminate aggressive cancers is more recent. Nobel laureate Paul Ehrlich first postulated more than 120 years ago that the immune system might control tumors. Since then, researchers have tried to boost the immune system to wipe out cancers. Recently, the 2018 Nobel Prize in Physiology or Medicine was awarded to James P. Allison and Takasu Hanyo for discoveries that have led to new medicines that activate the immune system and drive it to fight cancers. These therapies can defeat even the deadliest malignancies. Allison and Hanyo have revolutionized our understanding of how the immune system recognizes tumor cells and have created a paradigm shift in clinical oncology that will likely alter how we treat cancer for the foreseeable future. Standard weapons for fighting cancer. To date, our best tools for treating aggressive cancers that have spread beyond the range of curative surgery have been radiation therapy and systemic chemotherapy agents. For the most part, these treatments kill rapidly dividing tumor cells by damaging their DNA or disrupting other essential cellular processes. This has led to most of the significant treatment advances we have achieved in terms of long-term survival in patients with advanced cancers. It is believed that soon cancer immunotherapy will equal or rival the impact of radiation and chemotherapy for patients diagnosed with cancer. To understand the significance of Allison and Hanyo's discoveries, one must appreciate researchers have been trying to rally a powerful immune response against tumor cells for the past century. Prior to Allison and Hanyo's work, researchers believed that aggressive cancers grew unchecked because the immune response was too weak. The consensus was that if one could stimulate the immune system, it would respond and destroy the invasive tumor cells. Immune checkpoints. Allison and Hanyo, however, made a critical leap when they characterized two very important and potent pathways called immune checkpoints that can shut down the immune response. These pathways inhibit T cells, white blood cells that are charged with destroying virus-infected cells and tumor cells, and prevent them from seeing and attacking the tumor. Allison and Hanyo identified and characterized two different proteins called CTLA-4 and PD-1, respectively, which sit on the surface of T cells. When these proteins interact with matching proteins on tumor cells or other immune cells, the way a key fits a lock, the T cells fall into sleep mode and don't attack the tumor. In many patients with cancer, these CTLA-4 and PD-1 pathways shut down anti-tumor immune activity. Without immune surveillance, the tumors grow and spread. This meant that our early attempts to activate the immune system were like trying to drive a car with a brake pedal pressed to the floor. No matter how we tried or stepped on the gas, the brakes thwarted any progress. But Allison and Hanyo's research led to the development of a new type of drug, monoclonal antibodies that block the regulatory pathways controlled by CTLA-4 and PD-1. These drugs, called immune checkpoint inhibitors, basically attach to the CTLA-4 and PD-1 proteins and prevent them from switching off the T cells. These new antibody drugs have led to dramatic tumor regressions. The results are so impressive that the FDA has approved their use for a variety of advanced cancers such as metastatic melanoma, lung cancer, kidney cancer, bladder cancer, head and neck cancers, and other tumors. The excitement surrounding cancer immunotherapy is due in no small part to the fact that these new medicines are revolutionizing how we treat advanced malignancies in which chemotherapy, surgery, and radiation have failed. Furthermore, cancer immunotherapy has already become the preferred first-option treatment for some cases of metastatic melanoma, the deadliest form of skin cancer. It is currently being evaluated as the first-line option over traditional chemotherapy in other cancers. CTLA-4 and PD-1 represent only the first two well-characterized immune checkpoints among an expanding list of targets that have been identified on immune cells and are believed important for modulating T-cell tumor fighting. There are more than a dozen immune checkpoint inhibitors that have already entered clinical development, and there are endless possibilities for combining these new inhibitors with those that have already been shown to improve clinical responses in treated patients. Although immune therapy is a breakthrough, it is not without risks to the patient. Taking the brakes off of the immune system can trigger undesirable and, in some cases, deadly consequences for patients treated with drugs. The killing power of the immune system is tightly regulated to protect normal cells from attacks that can damage critical tissues. Removing the brakes with immune checkpoint inhibitors can cause damaging inflammation in the skin, gut, heart, lungs, and other vital organs. These risks can add up when these potent inhibitors are combined, and the long-term side effects of immune checkpoint inhibition are not fully understood. While the clinical responses to these treatments can be dramatic, long-term tumor regressions are achieved only in a minority of treated patients, usually less than 20 to 30% depending on the tumor type. Also, the use of PD-1 and CTLA-4 checkpoint inhibitors has not proven effective against all tumor types. In Allison and Hanyo's own studies of malignant brain tumors, they and their colleagues have identified unique properties that make them resistant to immunotherapy and have begun to identify strategies for overcoming this treatment resistance. Thus, they say they have much still to learn and significant room for improvement in order to maximize the benefits of immunotherapy for all patients. Nonetheless, they have definitively entered a new era of clinical medicine with an accelerated progress in oncology treatments. More than 1 in 3 individuals will be diagnosed with cancer during their lifetime. Despite our continued advances in cancer prevention and early detection, a significant proportion of these individuals will be faced with advanced disease. With continued rapid progress building on Allison's and Hanyo's pioneering discoveries, it is increasingly likely that a patient's own immune system will prove the most effective strategy and final defense against an advancing and relentless malignancy. And now from the lighter side of Smithsonian.com, why we think outhouses all had crescent moons in their doors. This article by Eric Grundhauser. The rickety old Wild West outhouse with a crescent moon cut out of the door is one of the most enduring symbols of the era. It's one of those images that you remember, but can't place exactly where you first saw it, which isn't surprising since it probably never existed. From cartoons to films to modern-day replicas of historic toilets, the cutout shape of a crescent moon in an outhouse door seems like something that is so ingrained in our cultural consciousness that it must have existed in real life. But it doesn't seem to have been much of a historic reality. I have never, with my own eyes, seen a crescent moon shape in an actual outhouse I could confidently date to earlier than about 1960, says Dr. Adam Davis of the Missouri Folklore Society. While there's not a great deal of scholarship on the origins of the crescent moon outhouse, Davis wrote a piece on the subject in 2007. Having a hole cut out of outhouse doors was definitely a real thing, providing ventilation and light into the stall. But no one is sure exactly where the idea that they were commonly crescent-shaped came from. The most commonly held theory posits that it was once the sign for a woman's toilet. As the story goes, in the 1800s and earlier, literacy wasn't widespread. So the common symbol used to differentiate between a men's privy and a woman's was that the men's door carried a sun or star symbol, while the women's stalls were marked with a moon. According to the book Outhouses by Holly Bollinger, this cosmic dichotomy was devised based on ancient imagery. With the crescent moon signifying Luna, or goddess Diana, it became known as a feminine symbol, therefore welcoming womenfolk, Bollinger writes. This might seem like a lofty reading of bathroom symbolism, but the moon has long been associated with a female aspect, and it's not unreasonable to think this would have been general knowledge. So how did the women's room symbol come to represent all outhouses? Bollinger's book goes on to suggest that men's outhouses were not as well kept up. So eventually, to conserve resources and labor, male stalls were taken down, and the remaining moon-doored stalls became a symbol of unisex bathrooms and outhouses in general. One version of this theory, shared in the 1989 book The Vanishing American Outhouse, says that it was during the mid-1800s that the general public forgot the original meaning behind the moons and just began seeing them as the symbol for an outhouse. This version of the moon door's origin, or something close to it, can be found all over the place. But the problem is that there doesn't seem to be a great deal of hard evidence to back it up. For folklorists, one of the earmarks of the improbable is it's highly articulated and yet without precedent or source. It springs into the world full-grown, says Davis. The provenance of the gendered account doesn't seem to stretch back very far either, with the straight dope only tracing it to a 1972 book called The Little Red Schoolhouse, a sketchbook of early American education, which describes male-female outhouses with the sun-moon symbols. Davis, in his 2007 examination of the symbol, contends that while there is evidence of moon-shaped cutouts in historic outhouses, they are little more than a decorative motif that seems to have been media-generated, then provided with a fictive back-formed pedigree to explain it. Davis also notes that in most cases of pre-1900s hardscrabble living, building two outhouses just for gender considerations was not likely a priority given the resources it would require. The precise origin of the outhouse moon is probably lost to time, since detailed records on historic bathroom design aren't exactly in great abundance. But whether it was a formally gendered symbol that developed into an icon or a simple flourish that came to define our thinking, outhouse crescent moons are abundantly used on modern outhouses. Today, you can find them on farms, in recreated historic villages, and in Elk Falls, the self-proclaimed outhouse capital of Kansas. Here's a cool case of a folk practice being picked up and made iconic by mass culture and then sent back down to the folk. I expect most people who are moved to carve ornamental vents in their outhouses nowadays will opt for the crescent. Whether it was ever a commonly used symbol or not, it certainly is the reality now. Well, that concludes today's reading from Smithsonian, the magazine of the Smithsonian Institution in Washington, D.C. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Mike Urban, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Today's program is underwritten with the generous support from Carl and Pat Keppen. We thank them for their support. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. Until next time, if you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Have a great day.